Welcome to Innovation on Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, and I'm at the studios at the University of Sioux Falls. And my first guest today is Dr. Charles Toll. He is a professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the School of Mines and Technology, and he joins us from the Rapid City studio. Dr. Toll, thanks so much for being with me today on Innovation.
I'm very happy to be here.
And I had my screen on the wrong page, so I apologize for stumbling over your information. So let's talk a little bit about the autonomous robotics program at the School of Mines. Just give us a quick little primer on that, and then we'll talk about some of the stuff you have.
We have quite a big program in autonomous vehicles, and we have several different types of autonomous vehicles that we're working on, and there are joint programs between mechanical engineering, computer science, and electrical and computer engineering. And to make these things actually do what they do, you need all those disciplines to actually make the vehicles work. And just to give you an idea, there's all kinds of acronyms running around. So some of the acronyms are UGV, which is an unmanned ground vehicle, which are robots that run around on the ground. You have UAVs, which are unmanned aerial vehicles, which you see a lot of in the news, and there's been a lot of stuff on PBS talking about what's going on in that world. And a couple years ago, we were here talking about the AUV, which is the autonomous underwater vehicle as well. And we have programs in all of these at the School of Mines.
And these are all just hands-on? Do you use existing or do you create new?
It depends on the program. The AUV program is, I'm an advisor for that program, and we're actually designing and building our own unique submarines. And the UAV program generally buys off-the-shelf submarine, aerial vehicles, quad rotors, and we have several different types. You know, we have the ones in the 10K range, the ones in the 2K range, and the ones in the $300 range. And we also have ground vehicles, which is one of the things that we're here to talk about, is we just got a ground vehicle donated, which was designed and built for the Army, which, of course, we did not build. But we both design and build small rover vehicles as well as buy them off the shelf, depending upon what type of research we're trying to do.
And that was my next question. You use these different types of vehicles for research, for labs, for teaching techniques. Talk about some of the practices that you do with these.
We do all of those things. We do some outreach. In fact, the camp activity was over at the mall this weekend, showing off a lot of the different teams and their different vehicles. That's outreach to the public to tell them about all the technologies that are going on and what some of these vehicles are used for. We have students that have student teams. Some of these teams compete very, very well in both international and national competitions on autonomous work, and there's everything from semi-autonomous to fully autonomous to fully kind of like RC type things where you a human in the loop controls it completely to other fully autonomous missions that are just purely research oriented. And we use these vehicles in classes. We have several classes where they'll actually learn how to develop the control systems and the intelligent systems and the general systems that hold the autonomous together.
And what's the future for these kinds of vehicles?
Future is growing. It's growing all the time. You see, in fact, I was just sitting here chatting with Charles before, Charles Michael Ray, who's one of your reporters. We were chatting because he's been out and talked to us. He's like, well, you know, I can go and buy one of these UAVs for $300. And what can I do with using it in reporting? How can I look at a scene in a new way? How can I investigate what's going on? You know, you now have a bird eye view for anybody that can afford $300. there are lots of other things. I mean, this vehicle came out of a program that I was involved with for my PhD at Utah State University. And they were developing both vehicles for the military because the military wants to get less people involved and move more equipment because they have to move lots and lots of equipment. And using less manpower puts less people at risk when you do that. To everyday farmers, we have been developing UGVs for agriculture for a long time. John Deere was working on a number of projects, and back about 20 years ago, a lot of them haven't come to fruition because of the litigious society. But those things, as those start to get worked out, more and more of these autonomous vehicles in all different aspects will be brought to bear. There's lots of things going on, and there's lots of things to still explore, even in the inner space of our own Earth. We know very little about the deep oceans. We know very little about going around and what kind of resources are there and how to use the and take care of the oceans. And these types of vehicles can help us do that as well as just think about next generation farming may be very, very different than it is today. You can think of ground vehicles going out and doing a lot of the farming. You can look at air vehicles going out and instead of taking satellite imagery, you have the air vehicle go out and take that imagery on a daily basis, on an hourly basis, and take a look at what's going on in the croplands. And then calling back and then telling the autonomous vehicles to go out and then service those croplands. Like instead of dumping water on the whole field, maybe you're only going to dump water on part of the field that needs to be watered today.
How large can they be? I mean, I'm thinking of this huge tractor, this huge combine. Can they be that big?
Yes, they can be that big. And that's actually, so the new vehicle we just got, it's about 4 feet wide and stands about 4 or 5 feet off the ground, and it's about 9 feet long. Hmm. So this is a quite large, it was developed for a scout vehicle, and it's a very robust military-grade vehicle that can do things that we just haven't had the ability to do. So they can be very big. They can be as big as any truck that you can think of, and they can be as small as you see the stuff on PBS all the time on Nova. They can be as small as a fly.
Okay, so let's talk about the vehicle that you received. It came from Utah, is that correct?
It came from Utah State out of what was their Center of Self-Organizing Intelligent Systems.
And what are you going to do with it?
Well, we're going to get it back into operation. It hasn't been used for a few years. It's so we're going to learn about it. It's an interesting vehicle because when Dr. Kevin Moore was designing it, I spent some time chatting with him about how we were doing flight controls. So this vehicle has some unique abilities that most AUV or most UGVs or AUVs or UAVs don't have. Its control system is very advanced in that it drives much like we do on a road. It doesn't use waypoints per se. It has a corridor, and it has an algorithm that allows it to drive in a corridor. So it doesn't have to hit waypoints as it goes. It just kind of drives along a lane or some kind of a path that's kind of given to it. So we'll be getting it back in operation and talking about doing coordinated efforts with our other programs.
And the way to control these devices, is it live or is it pre-programmed or both?
It's both. That's an open question. How should we interact? Some of the research that's being done is to what level of autonomy should the robot have? How much interaction should there be with humans, and how should that interaction occur, and how should the person be in the loop, and how is it presented, and how does the person interface with the vehicle, and how do you do human-vehicle interactions or cooperative work? So we're not just interested in just seeing how vehicles work together, but we're also interested in seeing how vehicles will work with humanity. So you want to think about, well, you may have workers in the field, you may have robots in the field, and they all may be working together, and you want things to be synergistic. So you want the robot to help the person, not fight the person. So all of those issues about how you actually present, how you actually get the robot to do its job and to interact with the human, those are all open questions. And there are lots of different things going on about, do you try to have a camera system on the vehicle that looks back to a human and tries to interpret gestures? Do you have gesture motions to try to talk with the vehicle? Is that the best way to do autonomy? When does the vehicle's control system override what a human wants it to do because of safety reasons? I mean, there's a whole plethora of problems that have yet to be even thought of, and solutions are very few.
And can there be, I mean, obviously there can be arguments and differences, but you can choose what you believe and go that route, and then will that cause conflict down the road?
Well, it's like every growing field. Somebody will do one thing and it may be successful, and somebody will do something else and it may replace it, right? So that's the field is trying to search out where the field should go and be careful. And there's a number of different, it's not just the practical everyday this is how it's going to happen problems. There's ethical issues with the use of these vehicles as well. There's tons and tons of ethical issues. And to be honest, the technology and the technologists are sometimes, they don't ask the right questions all the time. They don't always ask, should we be doing this? And if we are doing it, how should we be doing it? And what are the ethical ramifications of using these types of vehicles in different ways? Those are all part of the research as well. And it's very important to think about, what does it mean? You know, what does it mean to use more vehicles? What does it mean when a human and a vehicle have an argument? And will that happen? It probably will happen. And then who wins? And all of those things are in play.
You mentioned the underwater system, and give that you were on the program a couple of years ago. Give me an update as to where you're at with that. You have a submarine in the water of the mines, of the Sanford Underground Mine. Is that correct?
Well, we hope to.
We're not, you haven't
there
started
yet.
Okay.
Well, no, we've started.
Okay.
It's a student-led research program, so it's much different than when we, the professional, you know, PhDs are leading an effort. This is student-led and student-developed, and we actually have a website. And so they're actually building each subsystem and designing each subsystem as they go. And they're doing it from the ground up, and they're developing the whole submarine. So it's not complete yet. And you can see there's ebbs and starts. Sometimes they make two steps forward, and sometimes they make three steps back. So, I mean, it's an awful lot to get a full autonomous vehicle going. You have to worry about power systems. You have to worry about control systems. You have to worry about buoyancy. You have to worry about all the electrical subsystems that talk to each other, the sensor packages. You know, can you use cameras? How do you harden a camera to go deep, deep depths? Because we're talking about a mission to 3,000 feet. So missions that deep are that's 1,500 PSI. There's a lot of problems. There are very few AUVs in the world that can actually go to 3,000 feet depth. So all of these things are in play. We have more robots than that we're building. We have two smaller submarines that we're going to build that we actually are almost ready to put in the pool this spring. That we'll be using to start to work on the guidance algorithms that this bigger sub will be using, and they will be playing in our pool, actually, in SDSMT's pool, as we use them in tandem to try to map together, and they will try to go off just like a survey group does, and be able to do hop along the way, because there is no GPS underneath down in the mine. But we're making larger robots, and we're actually started to talk about the Park Service asked me one time, could we, if we got the big sub working, could we make a really small sub and then talk about going into the parts of Jewel Cave that you can't get to yet? So there's a whole bunch of different lines of thought and research that we're doing, and there's more than one sub that we're working on.
Do you get that a lot? Do you get a lot of people who come to you and say, hey, this would be really cool if you could figure this out for us?
Yeah, we get a lot of people that call us up or visiting, and they say, well, what do you think about this? It's kind of funny. Before I came to SDSMT, I was talking to the Park Service in Yellowstone, and they're actually interested in submarines for trying to find out about lake trout problems that they have in Yellowstone Lake, because they can't find where they winter. And that's a real problem because they're eating all of the cutthroats, which is the native fish, and lake trout aren't native. So they have real problems that they can't solve, that they've tried to solve, and having autonomous vehicles that can spend long time searching out and actually chasing fish is actually things that they were interested in. We were talking about finding extremophiles with them, and they're like, oh, well, we have this other problem. Can you think about that as well?
And would that be a camera or taking of photos? And how does it work when you don't have that satellite to kind of, when it's underground and it's dark, how do you get images and that kind of stuff back up?
Well, that's a real problem.
That's what you're working on, right?
That's what we're working on. There are different ways. There are different spectral bands. Just because it's dark in the visual band does not mean it's dark in other bands. There's UV, there's IR, there are many different bands. You can add lighting systems to see things. You don't always use just light. You can also, that's what sonar systems are for. And there are many different spectral bands to take a look at the world in. We just live in one spectral band. I mean, it's like the difference between deer. Deer don't see in the same spectral band that we do. That's why elk, you know, if you talk to a hunter, he camouflages himself very differently if he's elk hunting versus if he's deer hunting. So all these things are in play, and there's lots of different ways of looking at the world, and it doesn't have to be just through our eyes.
Well, Dr. Toll, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Innovation today, and I look forward to having you back with more updates as you move forward.
We look forward to doing that.
All right. Thank you so much. And when we come back, we will hear about the Ideas Competition happening in Brookings. You're listening to Innovation on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.